When an outbreak of E. coli killed 3 people and sickened 200 others a couple of decades ago, those in charge of food safety began discouraging the existence of wildlife on farms. This leads us to ask, should wildlife be allowed back on farms?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Oldson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Welcome out there to the 1,348th edition of the Food Chain Radio Program. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Manila who are tuned into the Food Chain podcast at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, back in 2006, a multi-state outbreak of E. coli 015787 killed 3 and sickened an additional 202. The source of that E. coli was found to be spinach from California, and the cause was believed to be contamination from the spinach farm itself. Consumers stopped buying the spinach, as well as other leafy green produce, and so growers had to leave their produce, their precious greens, to go to seed in the fields. Wow. Now, though the contaminated spinach came from one grower, the entire leafy greens industry suffered the consequences. As a result of their suffering and threats from the government, growers got together and formed the California Leafy Green Marketing Agreement, which in effect laid down the law on how member growers could tend to their leafy greens. Consequent to the implementation of the agreement, growers began fencing off their fields from all the wild things in nature that might harbor E. coli. Today, many of those farms are as barren of extraneous life as can be made possible. No deer, no skunks, no birds, no anything. But wait, not everyone thinks that farms need to be without life. In fact, some point in the other direction and claim that farms with life do much better than farms without life. And those contrarians lead us to ask, should wildlife be allowed back on the farms? Well, here to help us look for an answer today, we have two of my favorite contrarians, Joanne Baumgartner, who is the executive director of Wild Farm Alliance. Hello, Joanne.
Hi, Michael.
Okay,
nice
good.
To be here.
Good. Also with us, Sam Earnshaw, who is the executive director of Hedgerows Unlimited. Sam, hello.
Good morning, Michael.
Okay, we're all together now. Well, welcome both of you. I'd like to start off with Joanne. And Joanne, what exactly is a wild farm?
Well, a wild farm is supporting nature and benefiting from it. So it is supporting flowers that help with pollinators. It's supporting those flowers also support beneficial insects. It's supporting shrubs and trees that support beneficial birds that help with pest control. And these plants also help with holding the soil in place, reducing the problems of erosion, and providing connectivity for animals to move through the landscape. As our climate warms, animals are moving in areas that suit them best, and they need connectivity to get there.
Very good. Well, the very name of your organization, Wild Farm Alliance, suggests a certain contrary nature. Do you remember when the apple fell on your head and you made you decide that from now on I'm going to be a contrarian when it comes to our agriculture? Do you remember that way back when?
Well, to me, it's not being contrary. It's actually doing what people have done for eons and eons, and that is farming with nature and benefiting from all these different practices and processes that I just described.
Very good. So you deny being a contrarian.
There are a lot of farms that aren't incorporating nature, and I know you just mentioned food safety. There's other reasons why farmers don't put in the habitat because they don't really recognize the benefit, and that's where we come in. We are helping farmers understand all those different kinds of benefits and then also assisting them with implementation, with putting in habitat and other kinds of practices.
Well, Sam, Hedgerows Unlimited.
Yes.
Now, what's a hedgerow?
Well, hedgerows are basically living fences. They're like rows of shrubs and trees either alongside farms, along roadways, in areas that aren't propped. So living fences is a way to think of them.
Good.
As,
you know, Sam, my wife and I once had the opportunity to visit Australia and then New Zealand. And so we spent some time in Australia running around, visiting this and that and this and that. And then we flew across the pond to New Zealand. And as the plane approached New Zealand, I marveled at how everything, all of the farms were surrounded by rows of trees or rows of shrubs or something. But they all appeared to be tidally encompassed in growth. And we're all tucked together. It was beautiful. Entirely different than Australia. Is that what you're talking about?
That is pretty much. I mean, people think of England as being, you mentioned the word hedgerow, people think of all the hedgerows in England. And you, there's lots of pictures of exactly the same kind of landscape that you can see in England. But, you know, we're working on it here in the United States and in California. As a matter of fact, NRCS, the Natural Resource Conservation Service, and other government entities like California Food and Drug, CDFA, Food Agriculture, are supporting the planting of these plantings like hedgerows and windbreaks on farms.
Okay. Well, you know, on a personal note, I've known both of you for a long time. I've known you even before the word organic was an official word for the federal government. We've known each other that long. And you've always been advocating that people look in the direction of life. And so I'd like to ask you a personal question that no self-respecting journalist would ask anybody, but I'm going to ask anyway. Does being so like-minded as co-conspirators help you to stay together as husband and wife over the years?
Who goes first on that one? I mean, I have something to say about it. I think that it's a good, interesting question, and I think being a couple who are on the same kind of path in life, working on things together, has been a real special thing. That so it's not like I go to my job and she goes to hers. It's like we work together. And so we started our own farm in the 80s. So, you know, for 40 years we've been working. And, you know, there's always differences of opinion, but and it's like 50% of the time I'm right and 50% of the time Joanne's right. And so, you know, that's just life. So, no, I think it's a very lucky situation to be in, is to be living and working together with the person that you love and work with and live with.
That's very eloquent. Joanne?
Well, yeah, I feel very lucky to have Sam as a partner. When things come up that are complicated, sometimes I'll ask him his opinion, and he helps me think through things that somebody else who might be in a different field wouldn't understand the complexities, or maybe wouldn't know the people who I'm, you know, thinking about partnering with or whatever, as Sam does. So it's really helped, I think, me work better. But then also on a personal level, it's just, yeah, it's just lovely that we have this, a lot of the same passions and goals in life.
Great. Well, what a wonderful answer from both of you. Thank you very much. And what could be more precious than having a jihad together that, to bring life back to farms? Wow. So let me start with a big question. Why should life be allowed back on the farm? Because, you know, there has been so much fear installed in the ag community about E. coli and other bugs that everybody's kind of afraid of having a bird fly over the field. And yet here you are advocating this. But why? Why should they consider what you have to say? Joanne?
Yeah, well, you know, it's been quite some time since that spinach contamination that you referred to. And during that time, there's been a lot of research looking into what is wildlife risky, or, you know, what are the risks and how best can farms avoid them or reduce them. And really recently, a study came out saying that there are three things growers should do. They should not use raw manure. They should separate crops from livestock because livestock can carry pathogens. And they should be very choosy at using low-risk irrigation source. What they also said, it was ineffectual to remove habitat. So, it's not really about wildlife. That once in a while, wildlife can carry pathogens. And birds, there's very few songbirds or very low amount of pathogen risk related to songbirds and most birds. But when it comes a problem, it's because like crops are next to livestock and say there's certain kinds of birds, not all birds, certain kinds of birds will go into a livestock area and feed on spent grain and maybe pick up some pathogens. So you don't, that's why you need to separate them out. The raw manure, right? That makes sense. You don't want to put raw manure on, which is coming from livestock, which could have pathogens. And then choosing really low risk irrigation water, because sometimes that water can be coming off of a livestock farm and going into a creek that then you're irrigating from, and that's really an issue. And what these researchers are finding is that when you remove habitat, it can increase the risk. So it doesn't make sense from any of that. And okay, the diversity, well,
Joanne,
when you have a diverse...
Yeah, Joanne, it seems to be that you're saying that the growers who have denuded their fields perhaps weren't listening very carefully to what they're being told. And so we'll pick that up when we come back. This is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson with Sam and Joanne. And you stay tuned.
And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back. This is the Food Chain. Michael Olson, your host today. We have Sam Earnshaw, Joanne Baumgardner. We're talking about bringing life back to those farms and as many farms as we can throughout the land that were denuded with the notion that we have to protect the crops from critters. And perhaps the farmers were hearing too well or not well enough. But Joanne suggests that they weren't listening. Sam, do you concur with that?
Well, I think so. I mean, I want to say a few things here. Like the way you've considered that we're contrarians, I think you brought that up. And I think it actually is the other way around. It's this type of agriculture is what's contrarian, because hedgerows have been planted in farming and rural landscapes for thousands of years. Fields were enclosed as early as the Bronze Age, 3000 BC, and references to hedgerows exist all the way back to 500 AD in Great Britain. And and in terms of birds, like in the early 1900s, universities had departments of economic ornithology where they actually studied how insects were being, pest insects were being controlled by birds. So the contrariness comes from people going away from these things that have gone for thousands of years. Yes, I do agree with that. And the thing on the food safety thing that you mentioned, this 2006 spinach outbreak, was a real blow to us because a lot of farms at that time were doing grass waterways and windbreaks and hedgerows and that kind of, because of this incident, brought them to be very hesitant of it. But as Joanne pointed out, there's been an incredible amount of research that's ongoing showing that habitat's where it's at. Habitat is what's encouraging biodiversity that can help control some of the pest things. In the 80s, there was a farmer in Yolo County, John Anderson, who had a farm called Hedgerow Farms, which he grew native grass seed and other shrubs. He, with the Yolo County Resource Conservation District, they put out a book called Bring Farm Edges Back to Life. That was almost 40 years ago. And so it's a concept that's kind of growing. Maybe you referred to organic farming about how that's growing. You know, organic agriculture is one of the fastest growing segments of agriculture because the consumers are really asking for it. So I don't know. This, having biodiversity on the farm is a requirement of organic farming. So I think we're moving in the right way here, Michael.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, when the farm I was raised on up in Montana was an example of the kind of farms that have been going on forever, because the farm property was filled with life everywhere you looked, which was what made it such a great adventure for a young boy. It was life everywhere. Everything was busy with the business of life. And, you know, if you drive through a lot of agriculture today, you see a denuded field waiting to have some plants poked in the ground in it. And it's kind of sad in a way. But it is a form of agriculture that is, you know, it's industrial agriculture. So that leads me, as we consider this interest, this subject of bringing life back to farms, that essentially there's different kinds of farms. And it would seem to me that some farms would be very conducive to the what you two are preaching, which is bringing life back, and some farms maybe not so much. And I think, you know, of the industrial farms of precision agriculture that are planting fence row to fence to fence, like Earl Butz once told everybody to do, plant fence to fence and plow everything under and get rid of everything. And so that's what they do. And a lot of those farmers are operating on rented land as well. So it's kind of, I just wonder, what do they say when you walk on and say you have to make some hedgerows to protect your farm? And don't they say, well, I can't do that. This is not my land, and I need every inch of it to pay the bills. What do they say?
I think that's changing. I think that's changing, Michael. Some of the biggest farms in the Salinas Valley have contacted Joanne, and I'll have her speak to this now, about exactly planting like wildflower strips and hedgerows. So there is a change of consciousness there, and it, parts of it being driven by some of the big chains that buy this industrial agriculture. They're looking for that too. Joanne, why don't you talk about that? Because you're working with them.
Yeah, well, these big growers are, you know, some of them are really smart and are trying to figure out how they can, you know, have a productive, viable farm and benefit from beneficial insects, from other organisms. And so, for instance, these wildflower strips support both predator insects and parasitoid insects. The parasitoids lay their eggs in, say, a caterpillar and then kill the caterpillar and emerge. And these growers are not only planting flower strips, but they're also planting about 3% of the field with alyssum or cilantro. These are white flowers that support beneficials really well. And so that is drawn, they have a big reservoir of beneficials on the perimeter, and then they draw them through the crop by placing these plants throughout. So the times are changing, and as Sam said, it's driven in part by the fact that the buyers they care about pollinators, their customers care about pollinators, and pollinators are in decline. So we all need to help, you know, make sure that they're going to be around in the future.
Two reasons.
The other thing I wanted to say was that you were mentioning how it was lovely to see these hedgerows on the landscape. And the thing about hedgerows is these insects are only going to move so far away from a flowering plant like these flowering shrubs or wildflower or annual flowering strips. Like on average, we know researchers are tracking about 250 feet. These beneficial insects move into the field. So if you have a hedgerow, say, around every 10 acres of your field or some kind of flowering strip, that's really going to help, too. So the thing about having a perennial hedgerow is that beneficials are going to be there early and before the crop even is planted. And then if any pest insects try and move into the crop, these beneficials are on them right away. And so it makes sense. And if you have crops that need pollination, pollinators move farther than those beneficials, but they still, you know, they're not going to move 10 miles. You got to have habitat. I think on average they move, you know, some are big and some are small, but they move maybe 500 feet from an edge into a crop. So, and then having the more different kinds of niches you have on the farm, the flowers, having grass strips, having shrubs and trees and grassing your waterways, like Sam mentioned earlier, it provides different habitat for the different kinds of beneficials. And we haven't really talked about birds, but Wild Farm Alliance has been working to help growers understand how beneficial birds are, and we have lots of resources on our website about that. But so
dig
into that. It's really
now that you brought it up, how do birds benefit farms?
Yeah, well, there's songbirds that are eating pest insects. You know, birds, when they're nesting, eat a huge amount of insects. And like a bluebird will feed their a set of parents will feed their young 150 times a day. And their beaks are usually, you know, it's more than one insect when they're coming in. So they're, you know, they're just grabbing all those insects on the farm. And most of them, there's DNA analysis that show that most of those, like 97% of the insects they're feeding are pest insects, at least in this Napa vineyards where this study was done. And So there's the songbirds eating insects, but then there's the raptors, right? A lot of growers have been putting up barn owl boxes forever, but what we didn't know until recently is that a pair of barn owls and their four young will eat around 3,400 rodents a year. And that was, again, Napa, research in Napa. And so what's not to like about birds? They are really beneficial. And remember how we used to, people used to say, oh, insects are terrible, I hate insects. But you don't hear farmers saying that, because it depends. What insects are we talking about? And the same with birds. So most birds are beneficial. There's a few birds that can cause problems, and there's ways to deal with them. Like, there's some flocking birds, like blackbirds, that will eat your wine grapes. And so growers have to net them. But it's not all birds, and it's all crops.
Okay. Well, so not all of life should be brought back to the farm. You don't want to bring grizzly bears back, for example, nor blackbirds. But a lot of other things can be brought back and really brighten up things. When you have birds around, they're singing, and singing birds, wow, what a wonderful thing to have eating your bugs. Sam, can you defend hedgerows with the exuberance that Joanne defended birds? For example, why on earth would you want hedgerows? What do they do for the farm?
Okay, well, this is a great question, and I've been lucky to have been working on this for over 25 years. And so when we go to put a hedgerow, a lot of farmers come to, they're the ones that initiate and say, we want to put something along the road here and put one in. And one of the most common thing is to provide habitat for beneficial insects and pollinators, but there are actually other functions of these. Windbreaks is definitely one of them. They sequester carbon, and that's a feature that is important these days. As Joanne mentioned, they protect soil from the action of raindrops, and they help water infiltration. A good, healthy hedgerow is actually outcompetes weeds. So in a strip that a farmer has to herbicide or weed a lot, when you have a hedgerow planting there, you don't have to weed it as much. It stabilizes the waterways, it reduces the water pollution, and it also can act as a barrier to drift from nearby farms. So there are other things, economic returns. If you have lavender or rosemary or citrus, there are crops that you could put in hedgerows that actually bring back some returns. And then a lot of the farmers who've had these just look at it as the beauty, like bringing beauty and biodiversity to the farm. I think that's really important. And so that's one of the, to answer your question, that is why, there are actual scientific reasons why these things really work on a farm. And on the food safety thing, too, it's something that comes up. It's like, What the scientists are saying, you monitor the crop, not the habitat. And so if there's something in the crops, like you take action, if there's crop damage or if there's signs of animal feces or other things, that's when you take, they'll sequester off of area not to harvest. So instead of eliminating all the habitat around, you actually monitor the crop, not the planting. And the things that farmers look for when they're monitoring is, how many animals are coming in? I mean, is it one or is it a herd? What kinds of animals are coming in? Is it animals that aren't associated with food safety things? What kind of crop is being grown? Some crops are just not sensitive to that. And what's the harvest procedure? If there's a machine that's just harvesting without any kind of screening or anything to eliminate animals, I mean, that's an issue. These are things to look at about food safety things. And what are neighboring influences? Is there a CAFO right next door? Is there upstream water coming in from a contaminated area? What's the pathogen of concern? This is definitely something you look for. And the other thing is, does the crop undergo additional processing? Because one of the theories that was floating around on that 2006 spinach thing was that a bunch of spinach got mixed into a plant that was rinsing all kinds of different farm products in there, or spinach coming from other farms. And so that in the wash water, it got contaminated. So these are questions to think about, so that the monitoring comes on the crop and not keeps away from habitat. And habitat has been shown to really bring benefits. So
we're gonna pick that up when we come back. We're gonna have to take a quick break. This is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson with Sam Earnshaw, Hedgerows Unlimited, Joanne Baumgartner, Wild Farm Alliance, and you. You know, it occurs to me that it's gonna take a lot of knowledge on figuring out how to do this right. So let's talk about what happens when you meet farmers who ask, how is this possible? This is the Food Chain, right back.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, we are back with Sam and Joanne and you, and we're talking about bringing life back to farms that have been denuded of life in order to protect the crops from, stray sources of E. coli and other bugs. Who wants that? Nobody does. So how do we protect them? Well, some have said over the years that you have to pretty much get rid of all the extraneous forms of life and just get rid of everything, and that way you'll be safer. But Sam and Joanne say maybe not so. Maybe we should learn how to use the environment to protect ourselves from these pathogens and whatnot. Now, that's a very interesting notion. And, you know, that knowledge has resided within the farmer and his or her family for millenniums. But we've since moved away from that knowledge. And so I wonder, Sam and Joanne, what happens when you meet a farmer who doesn't have this knowledge, and they look at you and say, how is it possible for me to bring life back to my farm and actually have it do some good? I don't understand. Where do you start, the two of you?
Well, I'll jump in. We are helping growers put up nest boxes, songbird nest boxes, and it's a really simple and inexpensive thing they could do. And they, as you mentioned, it's delightful to have birds on the farms. The farmers always respond positively. And once they start bringing nature back, they are intrigued by it and they want to do more. A hedgerow takes a little more effort, or probably more than just a little. I mean, you got to figure out where you're going to put it on your farm and what plants are going to go in. We help growers do that, as does Sam. And then, you know, actually planting it, you got to take care of it like you would a crop, and you got to mulch it and irrigate it. And at least for the first 3 years, we're putting in native plants. So that's a lot. They are just so well adapted to the area that there's less management because of them. I wanted to mention, Michael, that we have this 2050 vision, and it's about putting 1 million nest boxes and perches on farms. It's about hedgerows to the moon and back and restoring the lifeblood of the landscape. But I want to dig into hedgerows, since the hedgerow part of it, since we've been talking hedgerows. And it turns out that if you went to the moon and back, it's 500,000 miles. Well, that's the same distance of hedgerows that used to be in the UK before they started ripping them out. They still have about half of them, and they're more or less protected. But, you know, that's a little area, and we have a big country. We can certainly put that many hedgerows back on farms and benefit from them.
Wouldn't it be amazing to have hedgerows on all of our farms, and birds, and flowers?
Yeah.
We got a ways to go to get there.
Yeah.
And you two are leading the way in that direction. It seems to me like it takes a lot of knowledge to figure out how to do this right. And you want to do it right, because otherwise you're wasting time and effort and money and everything else to build something that may not work. So, Sam, take us through a procedure. Somebody invites you onto their farm. Where do you start with it? You start with an evaluation, I assume.
Okay, well, that's a great question. And I just finished working with the Farmer of the Year here in Santa Cruz County, Tom Brose. You know, you mentioned that you had visited his farm as well, and he has a diverse vegetable and fruit orchard and farm here in Corralitos. And he wanted a hedgerow between him and this neighboring farm. So the first thing is we went out there and looked at the site, and the question is, what is your goal? What do you want from this hedgerow? And he wanted the main things he wanted screening from an adjacent field, and then he wanted the ability to have some habitat for beneficial insects and pollinators. So we look at the site, we say, how wide is it? How wide do you want the plants? Because a lot of times there's a road and then a field, and so you have to be conscious of how wide the plants are going to get. And so we talked about what kinds of plants he wanted. Do you want medium, short, medium, or tall plants? Do you want shrubs? Do you want some trees? Do you want some flowers underneath? And then so I came back and developed a plant list, just because we've been doing this for a lot of time. I wasn't the one that originated this either. Years ago, there was a scientist up in Davis. You probably are aware of him, Michael. Bob Bug.
Oh, yeah.
Was a... believe it or not, was an entomologist with UC, and he started started studying how a lot of the native shrubs harbor beneficial insects, and then they started planting them on walnut and almond orchards, and developed a list. And from that, we've expanded the list, talking to nurseries and other farmers, and over the years, that the list is quite lengthy of good plants that can be used. So anyhow, I put a plant list together, send it back up to Tom. We went over it together. This is what he wanted. And then I would go help him find the nurseries. There's native plant nurseries in the area and down in Monterey, and located the plants. And then for him to get the site ready, he would rip the site with a tractor and rip the soil deep to loosen up the soil. So a lot of times these are compacted areas that haven't really been farmed. And then talk about what irrigation system he would lay out, which would be drip tapes or tubing with emitters. And then get the bed ready, and then come dig a hole, put a bunch of a bucket full of water in it, put a compost is a great thing to use because it stimulates the microbial activity, but not fertilizer. These native plants do not like fertilizer. They grow too fast and fall over. So, and then if there's, he does have gophers in the area. We bought these gopher speed baskets and gopher baskets and put them on the plants. They're not that expensive. And put the plant in the ground, turn on the water, and step back and let it grow, and just keep it moist. And as Joe Anson mentioned, 3 years is usually the time period for it. So there's a run through the whole process, I think.
Mm-hmm. You know, Tom's farm is what I kind of consider to be a community sustainable farm, which is to say Tom very much grows crops for his community and brings the community onto his farm. And when the community and goes on to the farm, including lots of kids, what they find is a landscape filled with life. Joanne's birds are all there. Your hedgerows are all there. It's just a land filled with life. And as such, it really does sustain a community in ways that go beyond the food that it grows. It's a spiritually uplifting place. Now, there are other kinds of farms. And I think of Dick Pichot, who is probably the largest organic grower of fresh vegetables and greens in the United States, who's a neighboring farmer. And yet Dick farms land that he rents from other people. And as you said, it takes, 3 years to develop a good hedgerow system. So what can he do? What can farmers who have, commercial organic farms do that makes sense?
Well, to address a couple of things. First of all, I don't think he's the biggest vegetable grower in the U.S. He's the biggest family farm, I think, or he's got something like that. He's not the biggest farm, though, for that. And Dick has done quite a few habitat plantings. One of the requirements of organic, and he is certified organic, is to either increase or maintain biodiversity on the farm. And there are various ways of doing that. They can do it with cover crops. They can do it by using alyssum strips, which Dick uses a lot of those. But over the last 15 years, I've actually planted quite a few projects with Dick. And you're right, the issue of rented land limits, the ability of a farmer to do that. But nevertheless, they can still do it, because once it gets going, it brings cash benefits to the farm. They're indirect, but it means less damage and less any kind of pesticide use. And I know you remember Diane Cooley, one of our landmark people here in our area. She would reduce the rent of farmers when they put these strips in. So anyhow, Lakeside is doing a good thing. They have done some. They use other methods of bringing habitat in. I mean, they know they do. They need to. Look at any one of their lettuce or coal crops. They've got alyssum strips right down the middle, and he does a lot of cover cropping. So anyhow, I don't know if that's a good enough answer.
That's a great answer, because in thinking about it, you can't, as a renter, go and enrich somebody else's land unless those who own the land see what your intent is and realize that what you're doing is increasing the value of their land, in which case you could form a partnership that would make some sense. And that seems to be what Dick Pichot does then. Because in increasing the value of the property that he's renting, he's making that land more valuable for the landowner. And it would seem like, as was the case with Diane Cooley, charge you less rent and you increase the value of my land. That's a good deal for all concerned.
That's right.
So this seems to make a lot of sense in all respects, except for the big industrial farms. Now, Joanne made the case that they are starting to come to you and ask questions. Is this possible for them? And it seems like you're finding ways of making it possible for them. How do you do that?
Well, we have a lot of outreach avenues. We create these little 5-minute videos where we pair growers like Tom Bros with researchers that, like Tom was talking about how having hedgerows was really helping with his pest control. And for instance, he doesn't ever have caterpillar problems. Well, birds love eating caterpillars. They're these big, juicy, high protein nuggets that they can feed their kids.
Lots of good fats, too.
Lots of good what?
Fats. Nutritional fats.
Oh, fats.
Yes.
Exactly. And so we have these videos like that. There's probably around 20 now, where growers can go there and learn about what a wine grape grower is experiencing, or an almond grower, or a mixed crop grower like bomb. And not they're not just about avian pest control, but we have a whole project now about natural enemy insects and how to support them. We also put on field days. We have several coming up this fall and next year. We
one of them on a big farm. One of them on a big
industrial farm. A big farm in the Salinas Valley. We've had them on a big almond farm. Well, not huge, but significant almond farms where we put 2/3 of a mile of hedgerow on that farm and then talked about that. And in the field days, we bring in researchers to help describe, you know, what their research is that's related to this topic. We host webinars. We have, last year, we created a whole series on the role of birds in agriculture where we worked with 16 different researchers, and we interviewed them. And so lots of different ways to help support growers. And then we publish lots of materials that can be downloaded for free. That helps growers think of through these topics a lot more.
You know,
I wanted to mention that Inflation Reduction Act that came into being, Congress okayed it last year. That's giving the USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service a huge, huge amount of money. And they are going to be funneling that into conservation practices like we've been talking about. So that's coming. NRCS is a great, great partner for growers. And then the CDFA, as Sam mentioned, has a bunch of practice or supports a bunch of conservation practices.
So you guys are changing the world. We're running out of time here. And I just wanted to say one thing. It sounds to me like you two are just having fun. You're like Johnny Appleseed going across the countryside, bringing life back to the land. And we all thank you for doing that. HedgerowsUnlimited.com, is that it?
That is it.
Yes. And WildFarmAlliance.org, Joanne and Sam.
That's right.
Thank you both so much. And thank you all for tuning in. Remember Michael Olson's second law of the food chain. The farther we go from the source of our food, the less control we have over what's in our food.
Thank you, Michael.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.